Cancer can take away all my physical abilities. It cannot touch my mind, it cannot touch my heart, and it cannot touch my soul. And those three things are going to carry on forever.
Welcome back to the Voices for Victory podcast. I'm your host, Mick McDonald. We're back in 2021, and we hope you all enjoyed saying goodbye to 2020 as much as I did. We can't thank each of you enough for all your support in what was a very tough 2020. Please know how much it means to us and how important every donation is. As you know, 100% of every direct donation to the V Foundation benefits cancer research. But do you know how the foundation determines where that money goes? Which scientists are deemed to be the cream of the crop that will receive funding from the V Foundation? Today, we'll answer a couple of those questions when we talk to Dr. Bill Nelson. Dr. Nelson is not only the director of the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins and a V Foundation board member, but he's the chair of the V Foundation's Scientific Advisory Committee, which plays a huge role in determining where grants are awarded. Today, we chat with Dr. Nelson about his role on the Scientific Advisory Committee and how they determine which scientists fit the bill to receive a grant from the V Foundation, as well as how his career led him to where he is today, including his dash dreams of being a soccer star, and also where he sees cancer research headed in the future. And now, our conversation with Dr. Bill Nelson.
And I always have to think about what's important in life is to think to me of three things: where you started, where you are, and where you're going to be. Those are the three things that I try and do every day.
And we are now joined on the Voices for Victory podcast by Dr. Bill Nelson. Dr. Nelson, thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us today.
Yeah, it's great to visit with you.
So there's a lot I want to get into today with you, both focusing not only specifically on the V Foundation, but also sort of getting into the bigger picture of cancer research. But to start off, I'd like to give our listeners a little background on kind of how you got to where you are today. So I'd love to know, you know, kind of when you first realized that, you know, cancer research was going to be the path where your career was going to go.
Well, I don't think I'm unusual in this regard. I think almost everyone who takes a journey and gets involved in cancer medicine and cancer research had some starts and stops and were, you know, wandering lost in the woods or what have you. I actually, when I went away to college, interesting for the V Foundation and ESPN and the like, I actually went to college as a recruited athlete to kick soccer balls, which I did with some level of skill and didn't put much thought into what I was going to do after I was done, done that enterprise. I think I had some notion that I would try and play in the professional league that was there at the time called the NSL for 2 or 3 years and then go be a lawyer or something. I didn't think that much about it. I ended up majoring in chemistry, mostly because my girlfriend did. And, you know, by the time I had graduated from college, the NASL was in a little bit of distress, and I wasn't the most highly sought after character for that enterprise anyway. And I ran into someone who knew me because he brought his son to some of the soccer camps and the like. And he asked me what I was going to be doing the next year. I said, at this moment, I don't have any earthly idea. And he said, well, you know, why don't you come work for me? And this person was a biomedical researcher, a physician scientist. He was really a dermatologist in the sense he focused on inherited scaling skin disorders in children. And, you know, if as an athlete in college and stuff, I guess you could argue I had the mind of a 12-year-old or something, certainly playing games that kids play. And I liked working with kids, and I sort of got them in a sense, and they were participating in clinical trials. And I was blown away by this. These kids had a great sense that the drug they might be taking might benefit them, but they were, you know, they'd been around the block a couple of times. They knew it was unlikely in some ways, but that whatever that was learned from this clinical trial would benefit other kids like them. And I just couldn't believe these thoughts would come out of these 12-year-olds. And I can remember trying to explain to them what I would do. I would scrape a little bit of scale, it's a sort of a scaling disorder, off their arm. Didn't hurt or anything, but. And I remember one of these guys asked me, he said, look, what do you do with that? And I gave the best lay explanation I could come up with, saw that neither him nor his mom had any clue what I was talking about. I'm not sure I did at that point. And I said, well, you know, what are you guys up to? And I said, well, we have to wait for a blood test to come back. So I actually walked them through this medical center up to where the laboratory was and thought somehow if I showed them what the analytic things that we were doing in the lab that would make more sense to them, I realized as I got halfway into that, that it didn't make any more sense. But I saw that in this young guy's eyes, I saw that the idea that this much effort was being expended on behalf of him and the kind of, malady that he had was very comforting. And I had an epiphany. I went into the person who ran the lab. I said, look, I'm not sure I was supposed to bring this child and his mom up to the lab. I don't know if I crossed some line. He goes, no. When you do clinical research, you want them to know everything there is to know. They're the most informed patients ever. And I literally said, I had no idea that medicine could work this way. So sign me up. And he said, well, look, if you're going to do that, you got to go to medical school. And of course, I hadn't taken even a biology course. So the good news is that I was a strange candidate. I had a funny history, but some places were willing to take a risk on me. Others clearly were not, I should tell you. And I got started here at Johns Hopkins, did a PhD and an MD together, and never had any thought other than that I was going to do medicine as a research enterprise. And cancer is, it's got to be the best business to be in if you want to help people. It's one of these things where good guys and bad guys are clearly demarcated. Cancer's bad. People are good. It's pretty easy in that sense. There are no ethical quandaries, I find. And it's a great business to engage patients who are very informed, and you can teach them a lot. They can teach you a lot. And you work together to try and get a cure.
And who knows? Maybe if the soccer league hadn't started to go be run on tough times, maybe we never get Dr. Bill Nelson. We get soccer star Bill. Maybe not.
Who knows? I'm pretty sure that no one else had exactly that same journey. But other than that, yeah.
it's an interesting story. So you're not only a member now of the V Foundation's board of directors, but also the chair of our scientific advisory committee, which is a really important role. How would you describe to our listeners, maybe who aren't sure, kind of what the scientific advisory committee does exactly? How would you describe your role as the leader of the SAC, and what are kind of your important duties there?
Well, one of the most important things that the scientific advisory committee does is it reviews in great detail all of the applications from V scholars, from translational researchers, from folks interested in childhood cancers, from folks interested in comparative oncology, canine cancers in dogs and pet dogs, from folks interested in the thrivership, survivorship thing that Robin Roberts Fund supports, from minority investigators that Stuart Scott does. So we review all these applications, prioritize them, and then that enables the foundation itself, depending on how much money it raised, to go down that list and say, look, if we have a little bit more money, look at this exciting grant we could support, and then support them. So that's the primary role. The other thing, of course, the advisory committee does is try and give the best perspectives that we can provide to the folks in the foundation as to where cancer research is heading, what types of scientists are contributing. That's growing. There are physicists, data scientists, device technologists, all kinds of people coming around to try and make a difference in cancer research. And so the Scientific Advisory Committee can give some sense of this to the foundation leadership, and they can use that to explore what are the best partners for the V Foundation, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's an important to note. Is I think most people are aware that if they make a direct donation to the V Foundation, 100% of their money is going to go to cancer research. I think we've done a pretty good job making sure people are aware of that because it's really important. But
that makes a huge difference to the Scientific Advisory Committee too, I should tell you. The people, they really like that feature of this foundation. It's a very, I think you're right. It's a very important feature.
Yeah. And I think people know that and they're excited about that. And that's one of the reasons that they enjoy supporting the V Foundation. But then they maybe don't know once that money is given to the V Foundation, how it gets to these researchers and scientists. And the Scientific Advisory Committee, as you said, plays a big role in that. So, it's not just like anyone who wants a grant comes and gets one from the V Foundation, right? You all go through a very a tough process to determine which are the best and most willing and most exciting researchers who deserve these grants. So what, and I know it's not ABC, but kind of walk our listeners through a little bit of what's the process for determining what's a good grant to award when you and the advisory committee are looking through these?
Well, one of the things that we do is we take advantage of the whole field. So if you look among cancer researchers, the V Foundation is known to be a very high quality organization that funds really top flight stuff. And so we actually solicit from all of the cancer centers across the country that do cancer research. We ask them to nominate their best person, right? So from here at the Kimmel Cancer Center, Johns Hopkins will nominate the person we think would be the best possible V scholar. And we have already here at Johns Hopkins an internal process that we look at a number of different candidates with provisional applications and formal applications before we forward our nominee. So we take advantage of everything we know about what's going on in cancer research and who our top people are and send them to the V Foundation process. The same thing's true at the Dana-Farber Memorial, Sloan Kettering, Ohio State, Stanford, all across the country, Duke, UNC, et cetera. And so we get those applications in. We assign them to various members of our scientific advisory committee, usually so there are three sets of eyes that look at these applications in great detail. And of course, if it's one related to genitourinary cancers, that was my background. That's what I grew up as a medical oncologist, prostate cancer, bladder cancer, kidney cancer, testicular cancer. The eyes on that one of them will probably be mine. And so we assign them according to the expertise we have in the scientific advisory committee, and they provide sort of provisional scores, and we get together and look at all the provisional scores averaged out. You'd be surprised how convergent three different eyes are. It's rare that somebody says this is the greatest idea ever and somebody says it's the worst idea ever. That pretty much never happens. So we get a reasonable priority list, and then we go discuss among everybody, discuss each one of them. And in that process, the people with eyes on it said, this is what we thought. And then the other members of the scientific advisory group ask questions. Well, how were they thinking about doing this? And why did you think that was a good idea? And with that, we can revise the scores a little bit better, a little bit worse than maybe the provisional scores were. And that ends up being the ranking list.
Yeah, I think it's just important for supporters to know how in-depth this process is, that you all we really are making sure these are grants awarded to the most worthy candidates, and that process certainly ensures that.
Well, I think also, you look at motivation for a second. You know, if you look at the scientific advisory committee, I mean, the grantees and the people who awarded, become V scholars, awarded translational grants, et cetera, I mean, that's directly the output, if you will, of the scientific advisory committee. And so there's a great deal of pride in finding the very best, because that's the way they'll be viewed. When people look and say, who was on the scientific advisory committee? Boy, that person was good. Then it reflects incredibly well upon us and the whole foundation. So.
Great point. And I think, too, in talking to a lot of the researchers that we've funded over the past 5 years since I've been with the foundation, too, is it's an honor for them to receive a grant from the V Foundation. They know, kind of what it took to get that funding from when it comes from the V Foundation, too. And they're quick to say how important, especially, talk to some V scholars who are really getting their labs going. They do not hesitate to say how important that V Scholar grant is to them getting going.
No, it is the sweetest convergence of many things, particularly for the young investigators who become V scholars. So one is the funds, they almost act like they're double or triple the amount because it enables them to really get started. And when they get started, it's a concept that we view as leverage. The V scholar investment can launch these people up with great ideas, get them going, and then they can secure grant funding from other sources. So the dividends, if you will, of the V-Scholar funding are returned manyfold. The other is that the candidate V-Scholars are very aware of the who's who that's on our scientific advisory committee. And so being recognized by senior people in the field who they know as somebody, deserving of a vSCHOLAR grant is a definitely puts a little bit of wind in their sails as they get started on this journey of becoming the kind of cancer researcher who's going to make a huge impact on cancer.
So I think one of the things that can be difficult for sort of people who are just on the outside and, you know, sort of view cancer research only through the lens of, you know, hey, where's the cure? When's the cure coming? Which I think we know singular cure is probably not the right word for that. But I mean, I think if they looked a little deeper, and you certainly know this, they'd be surprised to see how many, you know, incredible breakthroughs and discoveries and new treatments have all come about, you know, thanks to research. I wonder how different things look now to you versus when you first got into the field.
Oh, they look incredibly different. I'd make just a couple of points. One is if you look at what we were doing when I entered the field, and I'm trying to add this up, so, you know, more than a quarter of a century ago, we were trying to discover anti-cancer treatments by sort of scouring the globe and finding chemical entities by screening, you know, from the Amazon rainforest or, you know, from a moat in a castle in Italy is where one of them came from. We were trying to find chemicals that could become drugs. And what they would do is they would kill cancer cells on a dish growing in a laboratory. And they all work pretty much the same way. The more you put on these cancer cells in a dish, the more of them you could kill. And then the clinical exercise was, could you give enough of this stuff to a person to kill the cancer cells in their body without injuring them too much? And so these drugs were in clinical trials. You take people who looked well, but they had advanced, progressive, life-threatening cancers and had no real treatment opportunities. They would enter these trials, and the drugs would be given initially at low doses because you were concerned about hurting the folks, maybe three people at one low dose and see what the side effects were. Then you'd increase the dose and increase the dose for the next three, et cetera, until you found out what the maximally tolerated dose, literally, that's the jargon term, but it means exactly what it sounds like. I mean, how much could someone take of this drug and what would go wrong if you gave them any more than that? And with that in mind, you had to go through this process of you had no idea what cancer it might work for. As you mentioned, many different types of cancer. So you go treat 50 folks with breast cancer, 50 folks with colorectal cancer, 50 folks with prostate cancer, with lung cancer, etc. If it seemed to work a little bit, that was a signal. Then you take it into a clinical trial and say, is it better than the best we got already? Or if we add it to the best we got already, is there any improvement? This process would take longer than a decade. Many people estimate it costs more than $1 billion per approved drug. And the reason for that is that 90% of the drugs we first took into the clinic turned out not to work. Nothing could be more different than what's happening now. Now we design a drug to be the antidote of an acquired gene defect in cancer. All cancers are fundamentally the result of acquired gene defects in cells that go haywire, right? So we map out this acquired gene defect. The drug is an antidote to it. We only treat people with this cancer having this acquired gene defect as its driver. We dose the drug enough to stop this defective gene from driving the cancer. And then we see whether or not it works. That process is much shorter. If we find something that stops the defective gene from working but doesn't have a great impact on cancer, we never think about it again. We don't go out and treat 50 folks with breast cancer, 50 folks with colon cancer, and the like. And this has created a much more efficient, both time-efficient and cost-efficient process. So the last I look, I think last year, there were 75, you know, drugs approved for cancer treatment. Back in the 1980s when I started, we were approving one or two every few years. So it's completely different. The other thing I would say, the way to look at it is, I mentioned I was a genitourinary cancer specialist when I was sort of practicing and doing research. When I started, prostate cancer was before prostate-specific antigen testing or screening, and a significant number of men would first discover the disease because their hip hurt, because they always had already had cancer disseminated throughout their body, and their prospects weren't very good. Basically, the half of them would live 18 months. It was that kind of thing. Now, if you look at a man diagnosed with prostate cancer in the U.S. now, it's typically downstream of a screening event. And somebody looked at this a couple years ago. The five-year survival of a man diagnosed with prostate cancer today is 99%. The crazy thing about that number is actually higher than the five-year survival for a man with who's of the same age with no disease of any kind. So did I think that this is what we were going to do? I was an optimist. You can tell a little bit by how animated I am. But even then, I did not think we'd do as well as we do now. And it's only going to get better.
Yeah, and I think that optimism is not, just, alone with you, Dr. Nelson. I think most researchers we talk to feel that way, that we're moving in the right direction. We're making really great strides. And obviously continuing to fund great research is a big part of that.
Absolutely.
This has obviously been a tough year in regards to that with, the COVID-19 pandemic has kind of shaken our world. But cancer doesn't stop just because this is going on, right? And cancer research doesn't stop.
It's been a very difficult year. I was sort of hinting to you, you can't quarantine cancer. If that would have been all we needed to do, we'd have done that years ago. And so people were still developing cancers. And we had to, build systems to treat them and treat them safely. One of the great challenges that we had were people who receive chemotherapy for their cancers. Very oftentimes we lower their blood counts temporarily and we tell them to take their temperature. And when they have a fever, we tell them to call in and they'll describe a fever. And we say, look, let's get you in here. Let's get some antibiotics into you. This is a common sort of meat and potatoes aspect of delivering cancer care. However, in the middle of a pandemic, when they call up and they say they have a fever, maybe a little muscle aches, a dry cough, holy cow, maybe they have a SARS-CoV-2 infection. And so we got to get them screened. And, this routine business that we're in all of a sudden takes on many different dimensions. And so we had to build physical resources. Part of our urgent care center for cancer patients, we had to build resources to enable them to be isolated and safe in case they had COVID-19 while we tested them, but still get the antibiotics we wanted to give into them at the same time. So we had to do a number of things like that. We had to convert in-person visits, many of them to video visits, including for our clinical cancer research kind of clinical trials, so we could maintain our momentum in that space and make the kind of adaptations that everyone's had to make in medicine and all throughout life. In response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
And how has cancer research maybe played a role? We're starting to see the vaccines for COVID-19 rolling out, certainly optimism along that front. How has sort of research for maybe cancer research played a role in how vaccines are developed for something like COVID-19?
Well, I think if you look at just the whole rapid approach to therapeutics and to vaccines for COVID-19, start with the therapeutics. The antibody cocktails you hear about that are antibodies raised against the spike protein that's the corona on the coronavirus that President Trump got and et cetera. These antibody cocktails, remember the first of the antibody drugs were anti-cancer drugs, right? One called trastuzumab against HER2, so-called Herceptin, one against CD20, rituximab or Rituxan. So that technology, the logic of building these antibodies and the know-how to do it and turn them into drugs and infuse them into people, that really got its birth in cancer medicine. The vaccine logic, Moderna was trying to make mRNA vaccines. Everyone's more fluent in that logic than ever before. They were trying to make vaccines for cancer. So yes, cancer research had a great impact on the capability of the biopharm industry to take on this coronavirus. But I have to give them credit. They really did so in an incredibly rapid time frame. It was astonishing. It's very impressive. These vaccines look very exciting. And they will be of benefit to people with cancer who might develop cancer. There was great concern all along that folks with cancer might be vulnerable to get infected or might have worse infections if they got infected. So these antibody drugs and the vaccines are going to be a great tool for cancer research. I mean, for cancer medicine. One other point was interesting is as the epidemic first started back in the spring in this part of the world, the folks in infectious disease and stuff really needed to ramp up the way they do clinical research in drug development and treatment development. And at most of the leading academic centers around the country, they turned to us. So I actually got a call here at Johns Hopkins probably in March or something. I don't remember the exact day from our, you know, Dean CEO said, look, we need to do, a better job, if anything, that we already think we can do with getting new treatments into clinical trials and getting them evaluated. You all in the cancer business do this better than anybody else anywhere else. So just what? You're now in charge of COVID-19 clinical research for all of Johns Hopkins. We need you to have a steering committee and let's put all the know-how we have from the cancer clinical research community and apply it to COVID-19. In that role, I talked to similar leaders at most of the leading centers across the country, and more than half of them came from the cancer research enterprise. So there's been lots of connections to COVID-19 and cancer research.
Well, that's so interesting how much crossover there is, and I think it just goes to show that, you know, continuing to fund this important research, no matter what else is going on in the world, right, is just super important.
Absolutely.
Last question for you, Dr. Nelson, and I'm going to let you put your ultimate optimist hat on here, since I know you have it on normally. Looking down the line, whether that's the next 5 or 10 years, when it comes to cancer research, where do you see the field going? Where do you see it evolving? Kind of, you know, if you can kind of put on your future glasses, where do you think it goes?
Well, one of them I already hinted at, and that's the way that the way we discover and develop drugs and antibodies and treatments is just getting just plain more efficient. And this is all downstream of being able to measure, if you will, all of the defective genes in anybody's cancer at any time. You know, the genetic testing of the cancers. And this has become widely disseminated and is really driving the individualization, personalization of cancer care. It was always personal, but making it more precision medicine oriented. You get the right treatment to the right person at the right time. And in the world of drug discovery, are we going to continue to discover new drugs that are going to make a difference? Absolutely. I think what we're learning is for small molecules, the ones that can be in pills and the like, that there are no undruggable targets effectively. People used to think there were some things you could aim a drug at and other things you couldn't. I think that we're figuring out ways to aim drugs at almost anything. And in terms of things on the surface of the cell, there's almost always an antibody or some downstream derivative of it that can be aimed at it. The second, of course, is this explosion in immunotherapy, whether taking immune cells out of the body and rejiggering them so you can put them back in, they go chase down the cancer, or taking the brakes off the immune system anyway so that it more aggressively responds to the cancer. These are making a huge difference. And, the folks who listen to this podcast know that's true because they see them advertised on television all the time. So they're making a huge difference. And that's just the beginning, I think, of that business. We've just begun to tickle the immune system to get it to chase after cancer. I expect to see a lot more ways to manipulate and redirect the immune responses in the coming years. And then the last one I would throw at you is as we measure things much more precisely in people, here are all the genes that are defective in an individual patient at an individual time. Here's what their the function of their cancer is in a PET scan, or et cetera. We're just plain leading away from biology that was, you know, in the time of Audubon where you painted a few pictures to true measurement science. We're creating a very large amount of data associated with each person and their cancer and, at any given time. And so we're turning many of our clinical problems into data science problems. And there's been this whole rash of development in the world of what some people call analytics or data science. You see it applied to monitoring people's shopping preferences so that if you log on to Amazon, For me, they may, so here's the latest soccer ball, or here's the latest, guitar you can buy right when I log on. How did they know that? That's from this analytics kind of thing. And applying that kind of know-how to cancer medicine, I think we're going to see more and more of. Some people call this convergence. So the V Foundation collaborated with Stand Up to Cancer to support some convergence research at the beginning of this. So I think those are the places you're going to see better drug discovery, more use of the immune system to treat cancer, and more of this data science convergence kind of approaches.
Dr. Nelson, fascinating stuff. Certainly we'll look at that roadmap as what we're looking at for the future. Thank you again for coming on and chatting with us for a little bit today. And thank you for all you do for the V Foundation, your wonderful role on our board and leading our scientific advisory committee. We are certainly in good hands with you at the helm there. So thank you again for coming on, Dr. Nelson.
You're very welcome, and thank you for having me. And there's nothing like the V Foundation. We're going to get there. We're never going to give up, that's for sure.
Thanks again to Dr. Nelson for taking some time to chat with us today. And thanks to each of you for tuning in. I hope you learned a little bit about how the foundation is determined to make sure your donations fund the best and brightest in cancer research. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you are subscribed to the Voices for Victory podcast wherever you listen. And we'd love it if you could leave us a nice review. They help others find the show. To learn more about the V Foundation or to make a donation, you can visit v.org. And also be sure to follow us on all your favorite social media channels at the V Foundation. I'm your host, Mick McDonald, and we hope you'll join us again for our next episode. Until next time.
To me, there are three things we all should do every day. We do this every day of our life. You're going to have, what a wonderful, number one is laugh. You should laugh every day. Number two is think. You should spend some time in thought. And number three is you should have your emotions moved to tears. Could be happiness or joy. But think about it. If you laugh, you think, and you cry, that's a full day. That's a heck of a day.